The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
And I've been working with some organizations in North America that have the funding to start an 11th team. It's not Andretti. And, now we're just putting some of those building blocks in place to make sure that we have everything that's required in order to be successful to both start a team, but also get an entry.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. Now this week we're going to look at how you run an F1 team and how the big decisions get made on driver hirings and firings, how to best allocate your budget to get the maximum results. We're going to hear from an experienced F1 team boss, Otmar Szafnauer, who in his time running Force India in particular had a reputation for getting maximum bang for his buck, finishing fourth on more than one occasion in the Constructors' Championship despite having a very limited budget. I'm delighted to say in the studio this week with me to analyze all of this is Autosport's F1 editor, John Noble.
Hi, how's it all going?
How's it going? Yeah, very good. And thank you again for making the time. I know you're very busy post Spa, so much going on in the world of Formula One, as we'll get on to. And also our chief motorsport writer, Ben Hunt. How's it going, Ben?
Hi, James. Yeah, pretty good. Thanks. Enjoyed the weekend. It was all good fun watching that play out.
Certainly was. But John, I mean, you were right there in the cold face in this one. I mean, before we get into Otmar, we have to say some sympathy there for George Russell. I mean, wow. After probably one of the drives of his life to get disqualified, Formula One can be brutal sometimes.
I know. I mean, I cannot imagine the kind of the highs he had been through in pulling off what, you know, was an utterly brilliant drive. It was an option that any of those top five, top six drivers could have done. An option that looked so unlikely for him to be able to do it. Multiple factors came together. You know, brilliant drive, and he kept the tyres alive. He held off Lewis to the end, did it all. And then I think it was about an hour, maybe just under an hour or so after the race, the first whispers came through that he was underweight. As of, you know, this morning as we record, there's no clear definitive answer as to what went wrong. But it's clearly somewhere along the system in terms of their preparations for the race weekend, they ended up with a calculation that was misstepped. Maybe it was the tyres were worn too much because of the one stop. Maybe a factor was the, you know, lack of marbles that you get at Spa and on that slow down lap, because there is no slow down lap because they come straight into the pits. So all these tiny little elements, we're talking about potentially 375 grams per tyre, which is absolutely minimal. So somewhere along the lines, there'll be a kind of smoking gun in the Mercedes data, and we'll get the answer as to just how it happened.
I feel really sorry for him, Ben, because it's something similar happened, or not exactly the same, but it was tyres and Mercedes not getting things quite right that cost him his first win back in Bahrain in the lockdown period as well, didn't it? So that's two heartbreaks he's had now in a short time.
Yeah, indeed, and I also think that this race was different to his previous wins in that he deserved it. You know, it was his own call, his own strategy. He led from the front, whereas obviously the last win was a little bit fortunate, capitalizing on a clash between Lando and Max. So this was all his own work, and I felt pretty gutted for him at the end. Actually, you know, obviously highs to lows, but of course Mercedes still win the race. So who would have thought we'd been saying that at this time of the year, given the start that they had to the year. But yeah, fully deserved as well for Lewis Hamilton. So that was quite good to see.
Yeah, two wins for Lewis now in the last few races, so going well. But it all comes to the same point, which is what we're going to talk about today, which is how you run a Formula One team and how you have to execute everything perfectly. It's something McLaren are not quite doing yet. Again, poor starts for Norris and little overrun in the pit stop for Piastri. All these tiny details go to making results. But there's also a bigger picture of how you run a Formula One team in terms of how you spend the money. Where do you allocate it? How do you make your driver decisions? I thought it'd be really interesting for you, the listeners, to find out how an F1 team principal thinks about these things, and who better really to speak to than Otmar Szafnauer, a very experienced F1 team principal with Force India, Racing Point, Aston Martin and Alpine. And ironically, he was fired exactly a year ago during the Spa weekend over a disagreement with Alpine's management about what was the right pathway to bring that team success. So it should be a really interesting chat. I really hope you enjoy it. So Otmar, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for coming on.
It's a pleasure.
You've been in Formula One since 1998, top roles at BAR, Honda, Force India, Racing Point, Aston Martin, Alpine. What I'd love to do is to get your help for us to understand how an F1 team is set up. I mean, how the spend is split across the different departments you need to have and how the income is generated. So if we start with the way you break down the budget, let's just say across drivers, design, operations, etc. Let's say we have 200 million to spend. Okay, we've obviously there's a budget cap. We can come on to that, but you've got 200 million in revenue. How would you divide that money up?
So for me, when I was doing this, and 200 million would have been a significant amount more than we had at the time. But the way I always looked at it is, performance first. So how much money do you have to spend at the margin to get that marginal performance? And, you know, if a driver for an extra 10 million can bring you 0.2 of a second, but also development of the car, as opposed to a driver for 4 million, that's 0.2 slower, but can't develop the car, you have to take that car development potential of the driver also into the equation to make that decision whether you chose a more expensive driver or you saved your money for further upgrades or further technological advances on the chassis or aerodynamics. So all decisions that we made first and foremost were, how important is this for car development? Now, every once in a while, if you didn't spend enough on infrastructure, the infrastructure improvement was more valuable to the entire team than, say, a driver or actual car development for that season. And then you would have to reset a little bit. And I remember when the cost cap did come in, or was about to come in, and it was known we were going to have both a operational, an OPEX and CAPEX, capital expenditure cost cap, the big teams with surplus money started buying all sorts of infrastructure because they knew once the CAPEX cap came in, they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it anymore because they were restricted. The teams that didn't have the money at the time suffered. They couldn't go out and buy everything they knew they needed, the
things
tools
like
they needed.
Wind tunnels and...
Wind tunnels, yes. Simulators, test rigs, exactly. Simulators are $6.5-7 million. And I'm sure they had decent simulators, but and it was probably at a point where wasn't quite worth replacing, but knowing the cost cap was coming, it didn't matter. You replaced it anyway. Dynos, gearbox dynos, things evolve, they get better. And at one point in time where the technology has moved on so much, that's when you take a step back and say, you know what, we're better off spending on technology now and infrastructure. But that the imminent arrival of the cost cap meant that all those decisions went out the window and you just bought the stuff.
What percentage of the total spend you would have would be on engineers, for example? What percentage would you typically spend on drivers? That kind of thing?
Yeah, so for me, it was always car development first. So it was the best engineers, or when I was at Force India, moving tunnels. You know, our tunnel was pretty much free because we owned it. We didn't have to rent it. However, when we moved to Toyota, for example, we had a massive bill of millions. But it was worth it because it meant better correlation. It meant you knew that when you brought an upgrade, it was going to work. If it didn't work, you know, you weren't looking at your tool as much. So all sorts of benefits. But yeah, for me, it was always car development first, driver second, because they're part of the car development. You know, they're in that loop. And also, we always had the fastest drivers that we could afford. We never, ever went with pay drivers, for example. And I remember debating with Bob Fernley, actually, just before we hired Sergio. Bob was keen to have Pastor Maldonado in the car. And I understand why. He came with 40 million. He was a race winner. But I just thought Sergio had more potential. And I convinced Vijay that that was the right way to go. And that's when we hired Sergio. A lot less money, but a faster driver with more potential. And we always looked at it that way. Always performance first.
So obviously different teams operate in different ways. Some of them, they have more prominent engineers maybe who have more of a voice. But if we talk specifically about how the decision on drivers gets made, it's very timely now. It's the summer period. There's a lot of decisions for next year and beyond being made by teams. Typically, how does it work? Who's in the room to make those decisions?
Yeah, so for me, it was always technical director, chief technical officer. You have to have him there. Sporting director, who works a lot with the drivers. And then generally, team principal and owner. And it was those people that would debate the list. I mean, I know there are teams that have algorithms that compare drivers, and you know, so and so beat so and so, and so and so beat so and so, and you know, sometimes those computer programs can spit out nonsense. However, it's fun to run them and compare all the drivers and then rank them based on the computer simulation and the comparison. But ultimately, it's a human decision, and the decisions are made, like I said, for me, it was always technical director, sporting director, owner, team principal, and they were the ones in the room. Occasionally, race engineers that had worked with previous drivers before, you would consult them on strength and weaknesses, and also the pairing. You know, you always looked at the pairing. If you could complement one driver's strength with, for another one's weakness, you know, that helped. I remember when we had Sergio and Hülkenberg, you know, Hülkenberg was a much better qualifier over one lap, and Sergio could look after his rear tires a lot better than Nico could. So that pairing, you know, they learned from each other. Sergio got better over a lap, and Nico got better at looking after his tires. So that was a consideration as well.
So we're about to be going into a major rule change, 2026. So you've got 1 year next year, 25, then 26, you're going to have a completely different kind of car. So what kind of driver pairing would you want to have? Would you be hiring a rookie right now for 2025, given 1 year of racing, and then would they help you enough with the transition to new rules, or would you like to have experience in the car?
I would like for that transition year to have one experienced driver, that's for sure. And I always like to have one driver that could get a lap out of it. You know, like I said, a Hülkenberg. And that kind of tells you, if you know and you're confident that the driver can get a lap out of it, it tells you where the car is. If you're always doubting it and saying, yeah, you know, he's a great racing driver, but he always leaves something on the table in qualifying, then you're always doubting whether your car is good enough or the car is good and the driver isn't. So that's what I would look for. But definitely in a rule change situation, experience matters much more.
So at the moment, we're seeing engineers as well moving across, and some of them are big names, like Enrico Cardile has left Ferrari to go across to Aston Martin, you know, obviously once he's served his gardening leave. How hard is it to retain talent in Formula One, given that there's so many competitors and people that, you know, are trying to poach your best talent?
Yeah, so, you know, in the past, for whatever reason, it was easier, and now it's more difficult. And it's reflected on the types of contracts those seniors are now signing. You know, when I first started in 98, you mentioned a senior, a technical director or a sporting director or a chief designer or head of aero, were on 6 months gardening leave, and that's it. Everyone else was pretty much on 3 months. Now, those key roles sign 3-year minimum term contracts. And usually what happens is 2 years into it, it's flagged to whoever the decision maker is, usually the team principal, that so-and-so is coming up on their 2 years. We better start talking to them about renewing. So in that 1 year leading up to the end of your 3-year minimum term contract, you're negotiating for the next 3 years. And that is so that the important or the talent that makes a difference to on-track performance you can keep. And you do it through those contractual negotiations now. But the other thing you do is you try to make sure that the others don't know who really is responsible for your performance. And you try to keep them in the background so they don't know who to poach.
That's really interesting. That's a bit like the way the football market works. I mean, there's no transfer fee, but that's exactly how it works. When you're a year away from the end of your contract,
you know, start negotiating.
If you're not going to stay, then they'll sell you to someone else to keep the value out of it. That's really interesting. So Rob Marshall, let's talk about McLaren, because McLaren, he came in after a gardening leave period from Red Bull, where he was obviously one of the key guys designing those successful Red Bull cars under Adrian Newey. From the outside, it looks like he's arrived at McLaren at the beginning of last year, and they've absolutely taken off. Is it possible for one person to come in and immediately see something on the car and say, you need to change this, and for it to make a difference?
It's definitely possible for one person to come in and say, you know, the secret sauce at Red Bull was this. You should be looking in this direction. That's definitely possible. You know, when you hear things like the performance is unlocked, the aero performance is unlocked through some mechanical design elements of the car, and you know what those are and how those mechanical design elements actually unlock the performance, you can point that team in that direction. You know, start looking here. And it's that direction that you then start looking in and find performance. Absolutely, one person can make that difference, especially when you have a massive rule change like we've had. You know, we're now into ground effect cars where we weren't before. And if there was some, like I said, some mechanical elements of the car that others didn't have, then it can happen. I'm not saying that that's what it was, but I do think that there are there's performance to be had in that area that isn't pure aerodynamics. But what it is it's an aero enabler.
That's really interesting. On that same subject, then, you've got the situation now where Adrian Newey has decided that he's going to leave Red Bull. He's left Red Bull, and he's going to be a free agent from next spring. Now, next spring is the build-up to those 2026 rules, big rule change, aerodynamically as well as new engines. So first of all, I mean, I think he's paid something like $15 million a year, which part of that must be make sure he isn't working for somebody else as much as to make sure he's working for you. But clearly Red Bull must have thought that he was worth that because they've been paying it to him. But how much of a difference do you think someone like that could make coming in, say, April of next year in the run-up to a 2026 new car?
Yeah, so by April of next year, most teams will have that aerodynamic sprint going already for the following year. However, you know, Adrian has done an outstanding job. Every time there is a big rule change, he's known for, not wanting to be in the meetings where the rules are actually debated, decided, written down, and have input and feedback, because he wants to, you know, just read them for what they are and not be tainted with knowing where the rules came from so he can find loopholes. And if he's coming in April, he'll have an impact, less of an impact on the 26 car than maybe a mid-season upgrade or the 27 car, but still an impact. You know, by April, the architecture will be set out. The gearbox design will almost be done. Soon thereafter, you're starting in on gearboxes. The chassis design will be well on its way, and a lot of the aerodynamicists will have switched over to the 26 car. All depends on, as well as where you are in the championship fight. You know, if you have to use your ATRs on the current season because you're in a championship fight and you want to retain first, second, third, or whatever you're fighting for, then perhaps you'll spend more of your tunnel time on that year and switch over a little later. But a lot of the 26 work will have happened by April.
How would it work? I mean, what people seem to be thinking is he's either going to go to Ferrari or he's going to go to Aston Martin or he's going to go to McLaren. And depending on who you talk to, the one is more likely than the other. But regardless of which team it was, from a team principal's point of view, your experience, how do you avoid dropping someone like that into an existing structure where you've got your established senior engineers and what have you without them having their noses pushed out of joint? Or would you think that they would all just welcome someone of that level coming in above them?
So that's a really good question. You know, if it wasn't Adrian Newey and you did that, then that's a real consideration. What you don't want to do is upset the rest of the apple cart, because nowadays with a thousand people working on in a Formula One team, it is really truly a team effort. You know, you can't just rely on one person, and if that one person upsets the team too much, then it's not worth having him, independent of how good he is. But with Adrian and his reputation and the way he works, I would think every team would welcome him. From what I understand, I've never worked with him, but I've worked with people who have, like most recently Pat Fry at McLaren. And, he gives big picture direction. He also looks at the details of the car, but other areas that aren't his, he leaves to everyone else to get on with. So there's a good combination of big picture direction, some detail, but you guys do your jobs as well. So I think with Adrian, like I said, I haven't worked with him. I would imagine he wouldn't be that disruptive dropped into any of those teams you mentioned.
Where do you think he will go?
I have no idea. I think the fourth option for Adrian is to go sailing.
Yeah, maybe.
Do nothing.
What are the key skills? I mean, your experienced team principal, we see different kind of the way that teams are structured. You know, there's lots of different ways of playing it. But for you, what are the key skills of being a Formula One team principal?
So for me, I recognized early on, probably in 1998, 1999, that the teams that are successful and do well are those that work together and collaborate. And if you can get superstars to work together and collaborate, even better. But I think it's that collaboration that's first and foremost most important. But it's also important to attract knowledgeable individuals that know how to make a car go fast, right? And then they have to work together. So I used to always think to myself, well, how can I go about achieving that? And there's some certain things that everybody enjoys, and there's other things that just some individuals enjoy, and you have to know what those things are, especially when you're managing them. And you know, everyone likes to be to go home and feel good about the job they did, and everyone likes to have the right amount of responsibility and the right amount of input on how fast the car is, if that's what you're doing, or how much money you brought in if you're working in the commercial department. And you've got to make sure that those accolades of people doing well actually are bestowed upon the people who did the work, and nobody takes credit for it. They go home, they go feel good about themselves. And then also, I always said, you know, to attract the best people, you've got to make it a good place to work. And that's part of making it a good place to work. You know, you've got to pay them the right amount of money, or you've got to understand those who are more focused on their salaries than on something else, and make sure you take care of that. It's also how you manage conflict between those individuals. You know, if you have a senior leadership team, occasionally a sporting director might not see it the same way as the chief engineer. And, you know, how do you manage those conflicts? Or the head of tire engineering might not see it the same way as one of the race engineers. How do you manage those conflicts? And if you manage those conflicts with what your parents should have taught you, you know, honesty, respect, no politics, that goes a long way in everybody pulling together and working in a collaborative way. And I think, and I've mentioned this before, I did an interview with a Harvard professor and Forbes magazine, and the professor said, collaborative species survive and selfish ones go extinct. And I think a Formula One team is the same. The more you collaborate, the better off you are. And if you have factions within the team that are a bit more selfish, you don't do as well on track.
Your last two teams, Aston Martin and Alpine, how do you see what they're doing now?
So I'll start with Aston. Lawrence has put in place the infrastructure required for it to be a top team. They've hired, and I was part of it, a bunch of good people there. They have two good drivers, and I've worked with both of them, and Lance and Fernando. And for whatever reason, I'm not that close to it. My expectation was that their on-track performance would have been a little bit better than it is now. I think they were, I don't know, maybe sixth or seventh fastest team at Silverstone. And my anticipation was that they would be fighting for the top three and definitely top four. So there's something amiss there or adrift. I don't know what that is. Like I said, you got to be close to it to understand what it is. But, you know, it could be all those things that I just recently pointed out to, you know, is it really a great place to work? Are they really collaborating? Everyone pulling in the same direction? You know, do you have somebody in charge there that understands the entire car, is making good trade-off decisions between the trade-offs you have to make, aerodynamics, mechanical, car drivability, drivers, all that kind of stuff. I don't know. Like I said, I've been removed. I know what we did when I was there. And then Alpine, you know, Alpine looks like is another reset. And it's unfortunate that, I didn't get the opportunity to continue on the road that I was going down. And what I was doing there is convincing really good engineers and talent, not at the highest level, but at the mid-level where the performance actually comes from, to come join the team because of the project that we were working on. And a lot of them, I talked to from a reputation standpoint, one of the best simulation engineers in the world. He was working at Apple when Apple thought they were going to build a car. He's moving back to the UK, and we convinced him to come to Alpine. I hear he's not going now. You know, one of the best aerodynamic structures guys in the world. From, I didn't work with him, but that was his reputation. Working at Red Bull, you know, I convinced him to come. A cost cap architect, which if you're good at that, you can unlock between 5, 10, 15 million of extra spend. And that extra spend at the margin is pure performance. That's what you're spending it on. He was at one of the competitive teams, and after lunches, dinners, coffee mornings with him, I got him to decide to join the team. But then I was overridden by the CFO of Renault Group when they got involved. So all those people, apart from one, have now changed their minds. And a lot of the good people that they had there have also left. So it's a bit of a reset. And those resets take time to even get back to where you were before. You know, Pat Fry was one of the first to leave, and then Matt Harmon, then Dirk De Beer. Who else? Head of Vehicle Dynamics left. Head of Aero left. I mean, there's so many of them. And I just heard 2 days ago that, the head of Composite Design has resigned. The chief strategist has resigned. So very senior people are leaving. And you've got to ask yourself why. And it's generally the team atmosphere, the culture, whatever it is they don't like. And in Formula One, you know, the higher the skill level that you have, the easier it is for you to find another job. And I always say the best guys leave first. So you've got to make sure that the team that they're working for and the team that you're leading is the best place for them, so they don't want to leave.
And finally, Otmar, what's next for you? I mean, you've been on gardening leave for some time, but do you see yourself coming back in an operational role? I mean, you've got so much wisdom, that's clear, and so much institutional knowledge. Do you see yourself doing that?
So if I were to come back, I mean, I'm going to be, I'm in my late 50s this year. My gardening leave ends about my 60th birthday. So I'm a competitor, and the one thing that I like more than anything is the competition. So to come back in a role where I can't influence how well the team is competing, I don't think I'd be interested. But if it was a role where I could help develop, build, attract the right people to improve a team's competitiveness, I'd be interested. But you know, there's only 10 teams. A lot of them have people in those roles already. So I don't know how many opportunities there are out there. But there's also the 11th and 12th team possibility. So that might be something that would be interesting for me. And I've been working with some organizations in North America that have the funding to start an 11th team. It's not Andretti, and now we're just putting some of those building blocks in place to make sure that we have everything that's required in order to be successful to both start a team but also get an entry. That's interesting too.
Excellent. Well, good luck with that. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks. Thanks for coming.
Well, John, let's start at the end, shall we? Otmar being quite open there, I thought, about his work behind the scenes with US investors to create an 11th team. I mean, there are 12 franchises in the rules, as we know. Andretti have been trying to get that 11th franchise, and quite controversially, depending on which way you look at it, not getting that franchise. What do you think about what Otmar's up to, and why are you so open about it?
Yeah, very, very interesting. Because obviously, Andretti has been the focus of the 11th century. You know, FOM, clearly they don't believe it. They bring added value to Formula One. Andretti has been quite aggressive in how they've kind of dealt with this. Have gone, you know, public with some criticisms. Have got the US politicians involved. So it's a stance that not everyone thinks has been the right way forward. You know, and they're coming from outside. But Otmar is someone who's, you know, he's been there, he's seen there, he's done it, he's got the T-shirt, wears the cap. He understands how Formula One works. There's probably an attitude that, you know, some others do too. When Haas came into Formula One, they got the experience. Gunther Steiner, who understood how the paddock works. You can't come in and kind of shake the tree and mess everything up and do things differently. You need to come in and do things the way things are done in Formula One, because the way things are done in Formula One is how they work best. So I think Otmar, you know, I'm sure it's in very preliminary stages at the moment. But it's interesting there is interest there. It is interesting that it's something that Otmar's been touched upon to try to move forwards. And it probably shows a sense of kind of realism and understanding from whoever this party is about how realistic an F1 project can be.
Yeah, very, very interesting. So let's move on, Ben, to another thing which I found really, really interesting about the chat with Otmar, which is driver choices. It's such a crucial topic. And of course, quite topical right now, because this summer break time, we'll come on to that in a minute, is typically a time when a lot of these decisions get made. But it's that little cabal at the heart of a team. Who are the people who have a voice in how you hire drivers? Interesting, he said there that Bob Fernley, who was one of the senior guys back in the Force India days, wanted Maldonado one year with his $40 million worth of Venezuelan oil money. But Otmar managed to convince the owner, Vijay Mallya at the time, to hire Checo Perez because although he brought only about a quarter of that sponsorship, he was not necessarily faster, because Maldonado had his day of being very quick, but he just was more consistent, especially in those days. And these decisions still get made today. I mean, I think Williams, we can look at, they've got a similar decision to make really about what to do with Sargent, who clearly brings quite a lot of cash. How do you see all that?
Yeah, it's that balancing act, isn't it, of commercial input and, you know, in terms of the actual driving ability, the skill to drive the team forward. I think it very much depends on where the team currently is and where it wants to get to. You know, if you're looking at like a team like Force India, you need to balance the revenue with the experience and the feedback and everything to drive that team forward. Whereas the situation is obviously very different for a leading team, where the commercial benefit of hiring a driver is not so important. I think the difference perhaps from when Otmar was talking about being at Force India and now is the cost cap. That's changed a lot of things in the sense that teams are now profitable. They're not chasing the dollars as much as perhaps they were before. And that affords them better judgment. But ultimately, it still is a judgment which they need to make. The Williams scenario is very different, isn't it? It's kind of, they've got the money, they just haven't got the results from Sargent, and consequently everyone's talking about, you know, whether he'll be replaced mid-season, whether he'll last the year. It's almost a foregone conclusion that he's out of the team, which is, you know, an awful situation for a driver to be in. And I think that's now you're seeing that come through in his interviews. You know, he's getting a little bit more agitated answering this question all the time, and he really just wants to show people what he can do, but he's not able to do so because of the burden on him to deliver. So it's quite a shame, but big opportunity for Williams to move forward depending on who they get next.
Yeah, I mean, John, we're now in that crucial summer break period where the team bosses and everybody, they go off to the beach or wherever they go on their yachts in the Mediterranean and think and talk to their colleagues and make decisions. And obviously they've got data. It's a bit like football, you know, buying footballers, you know, is very much now a data-driven process. It must be the same. And Otmar confirms that in terms of the way that the teams look at drivers' performances, how they lose places at the start or their consistency on different types of tyre, all of that kind of data. But at the end of the day, as he says, it comes down to human decisions. And sometimes people like yourselves, John and Ben, you know, you get asked, you know, what do you think about this driver or that driver? I've certainly been asked in the past, you know, by teams, you know, what do I think about such and such a driver when they're thinking of hiring somebody? So I think they listen to all kinds of people, but at the end of the day, they have to make a decision. And I'd just be interested on your reflections, John, on how those decisions get made, what you think the most important thing is.
I think the urgency of decisions and and the importance of drivers has changed a lot in the last 2 years in particular, that as a consequence of this grid closing up, that there's now so little difference between the cars that it's no longer a case that, you know, say 5 years ago, you put Max Verstappen in the car at the back of the grid, he wouldn't have been able to get into Q3 regularly, for example. However, now you can put a top line driver in any car and he will make an immediate impact and move that up places it shouldn't be. So equally, if a driver's not performing, they're going to be falling back quite a bit further than they normally would, as we've seen with Checo Perez at Red Bull. You know, what was a, you know, 3 to 6 tenths gap to Max when that car's half a second ahead is a world of difference between a 3 and 6 tenths gap when it's 2 tenths behind McLaren and he's getting knocked out of Q1. So these things have changed a lot, I think, and it's put a premium on drivers and put premiums on drivers at a time when, as Ben says, teams are profitable. They're no longer as cash strapped as they were. And the drivers are able to calculate some pretty hefty pay packets to get themselves on the front foot. So I think all these elements come together. And I think beyond the data point, I thought it was very interesting what Mark said about these, you know, little calculations they do. Because I remember speaking to Toto Wolff earlier on this year about driver decisions and how you weigh up, you know, going for an experienced man like Max Verstappen or going for someone like Andrea Kimi Antonelli, who's a complete rookie. And he says, we do calculations. We do how they stacked up against teammates, how they stacked up on tyres, how they stack up in qualifying in races, all this sort of thing. But at the end of the day, the human has to work as well. You have to factor in, as you know, Red Bull ponders its decision over the future. It's not just about, you know, is a rookie like Liam Lawson able on the data to deliver the lap times? It's the psychological impact of being beaten week in, week out by Max Verstappen. Are there long-term consequences for that? Does Yuki Tsunoda have the mental capability to be fighting at the front all the time, consistently and not making mistakes? So you've got the data point and you've got the psychological kind of human element to it all too. And at the end of the day, points are prizes. Drivers have to deliver points. And that's what teams care about because that's where the money comes from.
I just wanted to pick up, John's right, obviously, about the human aspect. And I think that for me, a case in point is Ocon going to Haas. And I think that Ocon has this reputation of being a bit of a team wrecker. This is all fresh in my memory, as having written a piece about it recently. But obviously a bit of a, you know, the accusation is that he's not a team player and he can drive wedges between the team. But it's interesting because Haas see him as totally different. They see him as someone who can galvanise the team, who offers a good benchmark against Oliver Behrman. So, you know, they're going flying against public perception on Ocon, and they've done their own due diligence and they are convinced that he's the right man to partner Behrman and get the best out of the team. So it goes to show that, yes, there obviously is the financial, there's also the technical abilities of the driver, but he's got to be the right human to fit in with the organisation. And sometimes that goes against our perception and what everyone else is thinking, because they found something else in his character that we don't know.
That's a really interesting point, Ben. I mean, Haas have made a few odd decisions, I think, on drivers down the years. But they are going against conventional wisdom in a way by hiring Behrman. Because as Otmar said, if you've got a major rule change, and 2026, let's make no mistake, is an enormous rule change compared to the past, particularly with the engines. And the way you drive these cars is going to be quite different from the looks of it. So a rookie driver, Behrman, will have just one season under his belt by the time 26 kicks in. Mercedes have got the same decision with Antonelli. If he doesn't come in next year, he's going to be coming in 2026. We mentioned earlier on, Liam Lawson's knocking on the door in the Red Bull stable. Hadjar is also knocking on their door. I wonder, how do you both see the path for rookies in the next 2 years, John? I mean, do you see us, there's some talented guys out there, but it doesn't seem to me to be a great moment to be a rookie in F1.
I think it is and it isn't. I think Piastri has changed the game a little bit. Because there's always this reluctance about, you know, can a rookie get the deliver consistently when he's thrust into F1 now where there's so little testing. But I think what Alpine did for Piastri and giving him, you know, lots and lots and lots of testing mileage in previous cars proved to be the way you've got to do it. It's the only way now to get your rookie prepared for Formula One is to give him a 12-month run-up, basically. It's what Mercedes are doing with Antonelli. You know, he's been testing previous cars. He's out in Spa this week, getting mileage and understanding. And this is what Mercedes is basing its decision on for next year, how he's performing in this car. And it'd be the same story if, you know, Hadjar gets a nod. There'll be lots of testing for him. Lawson's being given tests in previous cars at the moment. So this is the way to do it now is you do your simulator running, you do your testing in previous cars, and you get a long run up. And you've just got to kind of time the opportunity and hope that things pan out. And unfortunately, the driver market is a dynamic living thing. You can be an experienced guy like Carlos Sainz winning races, and you're in the wrong, you get out of contract, wrong place, wrong time, when the wrong opportunities aren't there, and you end up not having the hopes you had. And there are other times when, you know, Carlos Sainz could have lost that Ferrari seat and had four or five race-winning options available. That's just, unfortunately, the luck of the draw sometimes.
Yeah, just for context, for anybody new to the sport, you're allowed to run drivers in two-year-old F1 cars. And in fact, maybe this is Lance Stroll's great contribution to modern F1, because that's how he prepared, didn't he? He basically had a two-year-old Williams, and he went to loads of tracks around the world in the year before he came in to, unless I'm mistaken, I think that was the blueprint of how you do this. Got many thousands of kilometers under his belt in a two-year-old F1 car. And as you say, that's now, people have realized that's actually, although it's expensive, it's a really smart way of preparing the drivers.
Yeah, we're so limited with testing, aren't we? That is probably the only way that you can do it. To go back to Otmar's point, I think we do need 11, 12 teams, really, to get these young drivers through. That's what I would like to see, personally. But yeah, I agree with John. I mean, sim and testing is really the only way to get these rookies through. The only point that I would counter is if 26 is going to be completely different, which is what we're expecting, does it really matter? Do we need an experienced driver in the car if it's going to be all alien to everyone? Maybe we should go for youth rather than an older driver and look to the future. That's the only point that I'd like to make on that.
Yeah, it's a fair point too. Moving things on to a lot of the conversation, what I was really after with Otmar was, you know, how you make these decisions on key hirings and firings of engineers as well. And obviously massive lead times, you know, you've got gardening leave. It takes forever if you hire somebody for them to actually come and join you. You have to build in these long, long lead times. But one guy, it seems to me, who's made a real impact this year is Rob Marshall. Very low-key guy, very quiet, but he was one of the key people in Adrian Newey's team as the designer of Red Bull cars over many, many years. He left the team and joined McLaren, long gardening leave again. But since he joined them at the beginning of this year, it's almost as if he's kind of homed in on why Red Bull obviously is successful and helped McLaren to find reasons, you know, and changes they can make to their car to make them competitive. So I know it's sometimes too simplistic to say one person makes a big difference, but Otmar seemed to think as well, in talking to him about this, that Rob Marshall's impact on McLaren, John, has been quite significant.
Yeah, I'm convinced that the key to these, that there's like a key to understanding how to get the best out of these current cars that isn't so obvious. And teams like Mercedes struggle for 2 years to understand, you know, what ride height do you want? How should the suspension be shifted? How do you cure this, you know, endless conflict between low speed understeer and high speed oversteer that these cars are producing? So there's a lot of engineering difficulties and complexities with these cars that aren't so obvious from the off. I think Red Bull nailed it from day one. I think Newey understood exactly what was needed. And as everyone was chasing down, you know, let's get the cars as low to ground as possible with tons of downforce and flexible floors that seal them for even more downforce, which opened a world of bouncing and porpoising. Adrian was straight from day one, you need a super stiff floor, and then you address your suspension and setup and ride height and everything all around that, which Red Bull kicked off well. I think McLaren have understood that now, and every single iterative step they're making is about optimizing their car more. They've not, since Miami, there's not been a revolution on that car, but I think they just understand what's needed to make this car quick, and that's happening. And now it's happened at Mercedes as well. You know, Toto Wolff talked recently that something clicked and they suddenly understood, and now Mercedes are pushing forwards. So I think what Rob probably brought with him isn't a you know, magic bullet solution that you put this on the car, it goes quick. It's more the fundamental understanding of what is needed and the elements at play to make a current ground effect machine ultra competitive.
I think the other element is, let's go back to the human element as well. He's a larger-than-life guy who fits into the structure of the organisation, and I think he has just brought a lift to everyone. Everyone's seen a person of his magnitude come into the operation, and we was talking, you know, we've mentioned before, John, about how McLaren forgot how to win and they're making mistakes. Well, he's someone that's been there, done it, frequently for Red Bull. And if you see him alongside you in the trenches, he's kind of the guy that you look to lead you forward, isn't he? He's kind of that guy that you can trust. And I think that, you know, that's been Zak Brown's strength in the fact that not much has changed in terms of staff, but he's just brought in key additions here and there and made very small changes, which has seemed to got the best out of everyone at McLaren. So it's benefited the whole of the, you know, whole of the team, 1,000+ employees, by signing one or two key players at personnel rather than players and such, but you get my drift. But I think that's been McLaren's strength. You know, small subtle tweaks, but bringing in people in the right area, but also that fit in within the environment with which they're working.
And finally, then Otmar, quite honest, I think, when talking about Alpine. I mean, he didn't sort of what's the word? He wasn't bitter. And he certainly wasn't sort of, it was a wonderful German word, Schadenfreude, which is delighting in other people's misfortunes. But he would be entitled to feel quite smug because it has been a bit chaotic, to say the very least, since he was booted out 12 months ago, rather sad figure wandering around the Spa paddock saying goodbye to people. Or even though he's been around the paddock a little bit this year.
James, but he hasn't left. I think he's been to every race since then.
Well, I think he's certainly been to a few. He's a bit like Gunter Steiner, isn't he? Sort of floating around. But anyway, listen, I mean, he's quite honest when talking about the problems that they've been having. There's been an awful lot of upheaval there. And now we hear that Bruno Famin, who replaced Otmar 12 months ago, is also being moved out of that team principal role. It is definitely a musical chair, that one, for a new leader. And then little details like people, you know, he hired from teams like Red Bull have actually changed their minds since he was kicked out. So again, these long lead times, others have been leaving Alpine. I mean, Ben, how do you see what's going on at Alpine?
Yeah, it's the opposite scenario which I was talking to at McLaren, isn't it? You know, strong leadership, you know, creating environment that people want to go to and want to work at. Alpine's totally the opposite. It's gone backwards. It seems chaotic from the top down. So much leadership change, not just within the F1 team, but within the Alpine and Renault business. I think the whole focus has to be at the very top because it doesn't know what it's doing with the engine program, the F1 engine program. It's now made a bit of a decision in the sense that it now wants to go after Mercedes engines, which is a big decision given the investment which they've made in the operation. So I think it's almost got a bit of a identity crisis in the sense of not understanding what it wants to be. Does it want to be a manufacturer? Does it want to be a works team? Or does it want to be a customer? I just find it all very confusing. I found the whole Alpine rebranding very interesting as well. Don't think that's particularly worked as well as they'd liked it to have worked. Just a total mess, total shambles, which is a shame because, you know, we want to see all these teams competitive. They had a real opportunity and they seem to be going backwards.
Well, that brings us to the end of this podcast. I have to say, I've really enjoyed this one. Some really interesting talking points and very topical as well with all the decisions that need to get made now, whether it be drivers or engineer hiring and firing. It just shows you Formula One world just never stops. And that's one of the reasons we love it so much. It's all about the people, as Otmar spelled out very, very clearly. So thanks to Otmar for joining us. Thank you very much to John Noble and Ben Hunt. You can read all of John and Ben's world-class F1 journalism on Autosport online or via the app. Please do email your comments on questions to jamesallenonf1@motorsport.com. We'll do a question and answer session very soon. And make sure to check out all the behind-the-scenes F1 stories on Autosport and follow the Autosport podcast with Bryn Lucas across Grand Prix weekends. My thanks to Dre, Matt and Jason on production. And thanks to you for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We'll be back with another podcast very soon.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn.
and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.